Ladies and gentlemen, we have some applications for admission to the bar. Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm pleased to be here to move the admission of a number of the law clerks to the Court of Appeals. Bill Ferrani is a law clerk to the presiding judge, Easterbrook. He did his undergraduate at Columbia and his law school, University of Chicago, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Peter Lechman received his undergraduate degree from Wesleyan University, and his law school degree is from the University of California at Berkeley, and is admitted to practice in the state of California and is a clerk to Circuit Judge Diane Wood. David Lasiska received his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago, and his law degree, also from the University of Chicago, is admitted to practice in the state of California, and clerk for the presiding judge, Judge Easterbrook. Aaron Mandel received his undergraduate degree from the University of Michigan, his law degree from the University of Chicago. There's a pattern here. And is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois and is a staff attorney for the court. Mary Lebrecht is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, is a staff attorney, and received her undergraduate and her law degrees from the University of Chicago. So, Your Honors, I am pleased to move the admission of these fine young professionals to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit.
Well, they certainly appear to be eminently qualified. We have no indications here of a dissenting opinion, so the motion is granted, Mr. Fitzpatrick. You are all admitted. I welcome you to the bar of this court, and I wish you all long and successful careers as appellate advocates. If you would step over and take the oath, please.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Second motion for admission to the bar, Mr. Coate.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Larry Cody. I'm with the Department of Justice, and I'd like to sponsor Ms. Glazer here for admission for the Seventh Circuit. While I have just met her this morning, arguing a case against her later today, she does indicate that she's eminently qualified for admission to the Seventh Circuit.
Does she have a law degree from the University of Chicago?
I don't. No, not yet. No,
well, we recognize some others here.
So move.
Thank you very much. Your motion is granted. We welcome you to our bar and wish you a long and successful career.
Thank
Please
you
step
much.
Over and take the oath. Our first case for argument this morning is Wallace against Cato. Mr. Flaxman.
May it please the court. Following the 1975 decision of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Illinois, criminal convictions in Illinois and in other states have been reversed on a finding that the conviction rests on evidence that's the fruit of an unlawful arrest. This case arises from one such reversal. In January of 1994, a man named John Hardy was shot and killed. 2 days later, the defendants Roy and Cato arrested the plaintiff. That was in the evening of January 19th. About 5 a.m. the next morning, the defendant officers elicited a confession from Mr. Wallace. The confession was a false confession. It wasn't true. He didn't do it. Based on that confession, Mr. Wallace was formally charged with murder. The state court trial judge found that the arrest was lawful, and found Mr. Wallace guilty of murder. The Illinois Appellate Court said the arrest was not lawful and told the trial judge to hold an attenuation hearing. The trial judge held an attenuation hearing, reinstated the conviction. The Appellate Court said the confession was the fruit of the unlawful arrest.
Mr. Flaxman, I'd like to ask you something about the voluntariness of the confession, because you argued in your brief that the motion to suppress in state court decided only the voluntariness of the confession, and that the issue here is instead the truth or the falsity of the confession. But if Wallace freely and voluntarily provided the police with a false statement, how does that demonstrate a constitutional violation by the police? I mean, isn't the constitutionality of the police action here inextricably linked with the question as to whether the confession was voluntary?
No, absolutely not. A confession, the truth or falsity of a confession is independent of whether it's voluntary or not. The constitutional question here is first whether the confession was the fruit of the unlawful arrest and whether damages can be sought in a Section 1983 action for that. Secondly, if it's not, then we go to the due process question, whether by eliciting, by using psychological tricks and physical tricks to elicit a confession that wasn't true, that was used against Mr. Wallace at his trial, whether that deprived Mr. Wallace of a fair trial in the traditional, or I think in the traditional sense.
Well, with something else I've been wondering is, with your argument, are you conceding that collateral estoppel applies at least as to the issue of voluntariness as opposed to the truth or falsity?
No, I'm not conceding that. I don't want to argue that orally. I want to rest on my brief. I think there are some very interesting technical arguments that it doesn't apply, but it doesn't matter for the significant issues that are in this case. Whether the confession is voluntary or not pales in significance to whether it's was obtained by exploiting the unlawful arrest and whether the confession is true or not.
Could I ask you two things about that? Because the city argues that, first of all, the false arrest claim itself was waived by Mr. Wallace when he conceded that it was time-barred very early on in these proceedings. And the second thing I want to ask you, which I'm sure you'll get to anyway, is whether you think this court's decisions in Gauger and Wiley can be reconciled with our decision in Booker. Not the Booker that we all have come to know and love, of course. The
or
other
at least
Booker.
No.
At least.
let me deal with the waiver question first. I think in our reply brief, we characterized the waiver issue as waiver claim is mischievous. At the time the original complaint was filed, this court had appeared to adopt a categorical rule. And as we said in the memo filed in response that the city says was waiver, we're not asserting a Fourth Amendment claim in this complaint because it wouldn't go anywhere under the Seventh Circuit's categorical rule, what we thought was the Seventh Circuit's categorical rule. Thereafter,
why is that a good excuse?
It's not an excuse.
There was, at the time, a conflict among the circuits. There's still a conflict among the circuits. Perfectly normal for litigants to take positions that don't seem to be supported by circuit law in order to preserve their rights. What you seem to be saying is that even if you concede a position, you can resurrect it later. I mean, we've actually been through that once earlier this year in an affirmative action case, as you're well aware, and we held you can't. So why would this be any different?
In this case, there was no concession of an issue. There was a representation that the original complaint does not raise a Fourth Amendment claim, period. We didn't concede it would be time barred. We said, we're not raising it. We're raising a Newsom claim, a denial of a fair process claim. Thereafter, we filed an amended complaint after this court had decided Gauger and Wiley, and then said, we're asserting a Fourth Amendment claim because it's now viable. For the city to say we waived it because we asserted it in an amended complaint would be is the same as me getting up here and saying the city waived its collateral estoppel effect even though the judge let them file an amended answer. And we're not raising that. We don't make any issue on this appeal about whether collateral estoppel was appropriately raised in an amended answer after we said it hadn't been raised. And just for the same parallel reasoning, the fact that we raised the Fourth Amendment claim in the amended complaint when it had not been foreclosed by any ruling saying you can't raise an amended complaint should not amount to a waiver of any sort. This is entirely different than the other case where there had been litigation and we gave something up and we just actually abandoned a claim that had been litigated. In this case, a notice pleading complaint was filed, which didn't identify the legal theories, as this court has carefully instructed the bar not to. And in the memo, we said this theory wasn't being there. Let me get to the second question, which is, can Gallagher and Wiley be reconciled with Booker? When that question was addressed at oral argument in Wiley, a member of the court said, I think what Judge Posner was saying was that Booker was wrong. And I think it's important to note that
our circuit has a means of saying that earlier panel opinions are wrong, and Gouger didn't use that means.
You know, I'm aware of that. I think the court...
And therefore, both of them are on the books. And, of course, your problem is that if we have to go by all of our established precedent, your case is almost identical to Booker.
Well, it's different than Booker, because in Booker we didn't raise the claim, and let me go back in Booker. Aside from having argued Booker, the Booker panel was, there were three judges in the Booker panel. Two of them were on the Gallagher panel.
And composition of panels doesn't matter. We have cases on the books.
Let me explain why this case is different than Booker. In Booker, the claim was not raised that a false confession had been obtained by Booker from exploiting the unlawful arrest. That, if that claim had been raised in a 1983 action filed before 2002, the district judge would say, if you win on this, that impairs the conviction. If you say that it was a false confession, there can't be a conviction when you're litigating a false confession. If you say that it's the false confession was the fruit of the unlawful arrest, that also impairs the validity of any criminal conviction.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that the difference between the two cases really gets down to what the Gouger panel is talking about, which is whether on the particular facts the Fourth Amendment claim is just fundamentally inconsistent with the existence of the conviction, you know, the issue that Heck is getting at. You know, if you're trying to raise a claim that would undermine the conviction completely, you've got to wait until the conviction has been set aside. Is it a factual difference that you see, or is there some legal line that you can suggest to us? Because it seems to me that the city is basically saying they just can't live together. This court made a mistake in failing to do a 40E circulation in Gouger. Let's just clean the law up. And your position appears to be different. And if you're right, then we have to decide whether you are on the Booker part of the line or the Gouger part of the line.
As the city pointed out in Wiley when they asked that the case be heard initially en banc, Gallagher and Booker are flatly at odds. Booker is wrong and Gallagher is almost right. Gallagher should have been circulated to the en banc court, and I think would have been adopted by the en banc court, because the whole line of cases that's saying that when you're saying that when you're challenging the fruit of the arrest and saying that the confession was obtained by exploiting the arrest, and therefore any conviction that was obtained as a result of that, which is exactly the Fourth Amendment claim here, you're challenging the conviction.
But not always. Suppose in this case, you know, at the beginning, you know, there's everything is the same, the confession comes along, but then all of a sudden it turns out that there was one other eyewitness to the whole thing, and so confession or no confession, that conviction could stand. Surely that would be the kind of case that the Fourth Amendment claim accrues upon the moment of the arrest, et cetera.
I would agree with that, but those weren't the facts.
I know. And so what you really want is us to take an ex post view of the facts. Now that we know what actually was put on the table to obtain the conviction, we know that this one couldn't have stood without the confession, and which is indeed, of course, what everybody concludes finally.
Which is, I think, what Heck requires.
Okay.
And that's I've used up my 10 minutes, and I thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Ms. Knotts.
May it please the court. Mr. Wallace's conviction was overturned when the Illinois Appellate Court ruled that his confession was the fruit of an unlawful arrest.
Ms. Knotts, forgive me for doing this to you, but let's just start right out. Is it your position that we must overturn our decisions in Gallagher and Wiley? Is that your bottom line?
No, that's our secondary argument. Our primary argument is that this case is distinguishable from Gallagher because Mr. Gallagher was told in the first instance by the Illinois Appellate Court that he had a successful Fourth Amendment claim. Did you want to interrupt me? Or?
No, go ahead.
Okay, that he had a successful Fourth Amendment claim, and that that claim was necessarily inconsistent with his conviction. His conviction had to fall because the confession had to be suppressed.
But assuming that Gallagher and Wiley are still good law, in this court at any rate, isn't this case virtually indistinguishable in that a determination that the arrest was unconstitutional would invalidate the confession obtained as a result of that arrest? And the confession is really the only evidence of any significance that I can see in this case.
Well, you're correct that as it turns out, as the Illinois Appellate Court stated in its second opinion, Mr. Wallace's conviction had to fall. But that wasn't necessarily true. The Illinois Appellate Court's first opinion told Mr. Wallace that he had a successful Fourth Amendment claim, but his conviction possibly could still stand if the confession was admissible, and it remanded for further proceedings on the admissibility of the confession. We believe that this is the type of situation that Heck's footnote 7 describes.
But why shouldn't we look at the last word from the Illinois Appellate Court, and indeed even from a broader point of view? Because it seems to me once we have all the information that we're going to get from the Illinois Appellate Court and the second opinion is rendered, everything is erased that has gone before. It has vacated the conviction. It has sent it back with the opportunity, of course, for the state to retry. The state, for reasons, you know, as we know, dealing with the evidence, chooses not to do so. But there are a couple of things that bother me about your position. One of them is that there's any force left to earlier trial court rulings that have now been erased by the Illinois Appellate Court. I don't see how we could have collateral estoppel effect once the Illinois Appellate Court has vacated everything that has gone on before. That's one of the exceptions to collateral estoppel. And I also don't see how we can say, in the end, it's the judgment of the Illinois Appellate Court that this all has to be set aside. Its reasoning along the way is interesting, but ultimately not important.
Well, I guess if I could just make 2 points. First of all, on the collateral estoppel issue, as it goes to the coercion claim, Mr. Wallace actually never appealed the trial court's finding. That
may be true, but eventually the judgment of the Illinois Appellate Court the second time around was to vacate what had gone on before it. So I don't see how we take one fact finding in a vacated opinion and give it preclusive effect.
Well, I've certainly never heard Mr. Wallace make the argument that collateral estoppel doesn't apply because the trial court's opinion was later overturned because the Illinois Appellate Court never even considered the coercion ruling.
Indeed, but that would be a good reason why issue preclusion is inapplicable. It's an ordinary requirement of issue preclusion that the issue have been actually and necessarily resolved in the litigation. And if the judgment is reversed on a different ground, it was not necessarily resolved in the litigation. We learned that its resolution was unnecessary.
Well, it was resolved in the trial court, and then he opted not to appeal. But if I could address, then you had a second issue,
right, the other point,
and relating
yeah.
to the trial court's, or I'm sorry, the Illinois Appellate Court's second decision, and our view of that decision just shows that although the conviction and the successful false arrest claim, it turns out they couldn't stand, it wasn't necessarily so. And
but that's, isn't that inconsistent with Gallagher, though? I mean, I understand. That would be one way you could structure this law, which, as I understand, the city has been arguing is a better way to do it. You know, all Fourth Amendment claims always accrue at the beginning. There's never any look back. But Gallagher seems to be a look back, if you were exception to that approach. And I just don't see how, you know, once all is said and done, if you're ever going to look back, once you've got the second Illinois opinion, wouldn't this be the time to do it?
Well, certainly if this court is going to read the Gauger case as you describe, Gauger and Wiley are inconsistent with Booker and Washington, and that is our secondary argument. And if this court concludes that the two lines of cases are inconsistent, the court is going to have to choose between them. And for the reasons we explain in our brief, we believe that the earlier cases, Booker, Washington, and also Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Gonzalez versus Entrance.
It doesn't matter who wrote opinions of.
Okay, forgive me.
Having already reminded your adversary of that.
Forgive me, Your Honor. But what I did want to say is our position is that the earlier opinions are more faithful to Heck, and then also the Supreme Court's recent decision in Nelson, which was decided after Gauger and Wiley, so wouldn't have been considered in Gauger and Wiley.
The only thing that strikes me about that is if the rule you're arguing for were the rule, then it's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which a defendant would file a motion to suppress under the Fourth Amendment and not simultaneously file a protective 1983 action against the police officers who arrested him, just in case it turns out later on, you know, 5 years down the road, that the Illinois Appellate Court rules in his favor. It strikes me that a lot of unnecessary litigation is going to be cluttering up the courts if we don't have some safety valve like the Gauger approach.
Well, I think that the district court's opinion does address this. I mean, the district court held that Mr. Wallace's false arrest claim accrued at the time of the Illinois Appellate Court's first opinion because that was the date on which he was told by a state appellate court that he had a successful false arrest claim, but that his conviction might still be able to stand.
Why is that consistent with Heck? I mean, I would have thought Heck. The, as you're arguing, the possibility was always there, even before the Illinois court's first opinion. So why doesn't Heck say just cleanly it accrues at the moment of the arrest?
Well, that certainly is our position, and we rely on Booker and Washington for that position. But we also acknowledge the possibility the district court raised that the claim could have arisen at the time of the first opinion because it was crystal clear on that date that he had the successful false arrest claim, but that his conviction perhaps could still stand.
Hmm. Okay.
On the confession claim, Mr. Wallace's primary argument seems to be... and I'm sorry, if I could just return to the Fourth Amendment claim, I apologize. I did want to address the issue of waiver, because one thing that's significant in this case is that the Gauger case upon which Mr. Wallace relies was decided 5 months before the district court issued his first summary judgment opinion. He's explained, you know, why he abandoned the claim in the first instance, but he has never explained why during that 5 months he did not make the Gauger arguments he's making now to the district court. And under these circumstances, we believe the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that Fourth Amendment claim was waived.
But waiver is a funny word to use because at least what Mr. Flaxman is saying is they were just trying to amend the complaint, just like you amended your answer, and certainly that's a decision that's within the discretion of the district court, too, and discretion that you're relying on. But waiver is a harsher ground than forfeiture or simply abuse of discretion about amending complaints. And the thing that troubles me about the district court's reasoning is the district court says all sorts of things that make it look as though he was expecting a lot of facts or legal theories to be pleaded in the complaint. And that's not, as we all know, you know, that's not what needs to be done.
Well, I think the situation with the amendment to our answer and then the amendment to the complaint are different because we asserted the collateral estoppel defense just as soon as we got the criminal trial transcripts that made it clear to us the defense was even applicable. His situation is quite different because he doesn't explain. He knew about Gauger for 5 months. In fact, we brought Gauger to the district court's attention while the court was reviewing the summary judgment briefs. He never popped up and made his argument when it became clear that argument was available to him. And I think under those circumstances, because we acted as quickly as we could and he did not, that explains why the district court came out different ways on those issues. On the confession claim, Mr. Wallace's primary argument seems to be that his confession was false. But that argument was never presented to the district court, and over and above that does not state a cognizable claim. The United States Constitution is not violated because someone, while in police custody, confesses to a crime he did not commit. The United States Constitution is violated if the police coerce a confession in violation of the Fifth Amendment, but here the state court did rule on that issue, and Mr. Wallace is therefore collaterally estopped from pursuing it in this litigation.
What if we hypothetically disagreed with your collateral estoppel argument? The state court has said some things, but he certainly right now could say, I presented this to the state court. There's no procedural default in that sense. And he's still making the combined argument that it was the circumstances of the arrest and the fact that the arrest took place and the coerced confession, you know, the psychological coercion occurred. Without collateral estoppel, where are you on this?
You mean with regard to the truth or falsity or with regard to the coercion? Because the truth
The link between, I mean, I suppose okay. It's hard to de-link them in some ways because if somebody wants to go into a police station and announce that they've robbed a bank and the police say, fine, you know, we'll put you in prison, and the person for whatever peculiar reason has decided he wants to spend time in prison, maybe that doesn't violate the Constitution. It's a little odd to think of that, but of course these facts are more complicated.
Well, on the truth or falsity, our position is that there simply is no Fifth Amendment violation simply because someone confesses to a crime they didn't commit. The Fifth Amendment prohibits the use of coerced confessions, not false confessions. Now, there is, as Mr. Flaxman indicated, a due process claim under Newsom based upon the suppression of exculpatory evidence. But Mr. Wallace can't show that any evidence was suppressed about his confession.
But just struck me that might be a narrow way of construing. I mean, Newsom is dealing with one kind of claim. What he's saying is there may be a due process claim if the police coerce a confession out of somebody and then that later gets used.
Well, I believe his theory is that the police coerce a confession and then they suppress evidence about it. That is what he
well,
would
evidence
have to
of
show
the
to
circumstances.
Prevail under the due process. Yes. But in this case, of course, Mr. Wallace was present at his interrogation, and he knew everything about the circumstances of the confession, so nothing was suppressed. That follows straight from this court's case, Gauger, where the Gauger court held that a due process claim under this type of circumstance simply makes no sense. Now, also you asked about the...
So is it your view that the police should be able to coerce in any way they wish without ever facing any kind of punishment for that, you know, beat people up or whatever? Where is the sanction for that kind of behavior? If it's not in the suppression of evidence and if it's not in a due process claim and if it's not in any kind of claim, is this just okay police behavior?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, of course, if someone is beaten by the police, they could bring an excessive force claim, but that would accrue at the time.
And what about psychological coercion then, just locking somebody up for 9 hours?
Well, if that type of conduct did not rise to the level of a Fifth Amendment violation, there would potentially be a claim under the Due Process Clause if the police concealed information about the circumstances
of the confession. But there's no underlying claim for the psychological coercion. You're focusing again on the concealment as opposed to just the action.
Unless if the coercion rose to the level of a Fifth Amendment violation, there arguably would be.
Where is that? Where do we hit that level?
Well, that would go to the determination of whether the confession were voluntary or involuntary. It's not an issue I've briefed because it's not an argument that he made.
In other words, the police misconduct in this case is the coercion and the intimidation, and that, of course, would impact the voluntariness of the confession.
Yes, and our view on that is that he's collaterally estopped from asserting that his confession was involuntary. I realize the court has expressed some reservations about that view, and so our secondary argument on that issue is the immunity issue, which we do raise in our brief. And our view on that issue is that to the extent the police coerced the confession, that those acts themselves did not state a constitutional claim because it's only the use of the coercion at trial that would state a constitutional claim. The Chavez case holds that simply coercing a confession is not in and of itself a violation.
Coercing a confession with psychological means. I mean, you're not doubting that beating somebody in order to get him to confess is at that instant a constitutional claim and immediately actionable.
Well, absolutely. As I indicated to Judge Wood, that would be an excessive force claim.
You keep making the broader claim that coercing a confession is not actionable. It's not, I'm sure, what you mean.
What I'm trying to say is that that the coercion issue was decided by the state court, and he is collaterally estopped from asserting it here. To the extent this court rejects the collateral estoppel argument, the detectives have immunity from any testimony they gave at trial about the confession under
thank
the.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Knotts.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Flaxman?
Very briefly, I just want to respond to what I think is a misremembering of what happened in the trial court. And get back to the waiver that. We argue there's a difference between abandoning an issue, which we didn't do, and not asserting an issue, which is what we did in the original complaint. And the city argues that it sought to amend its answer as soon as it discovered there was grounds for a collateral estoppel defense.
Was that a month or two that had passed before they amended?
Well, they amended after filing summary judgment,
right,
raising collateral estoppel, and after we filed a response saying, you waived it, you didn't put it in your answer. Then they put it in their
right
answer.
Was that like what?
It's about
a month.
After they filed summary judgment. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of